Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Packet Protector, the podcast at the intersection of networking and security. I'm Jennifer J.J. Manella here with Drew Conley Murray. And today we're talking about subsea cables and communications. And we have a fantastic guest joining us. Andy Champagne is the SVP and CTO of Akamai Labs. He has a long history of working in technology, and I think I could go on for hours asking questions, but we really are going to geek out on this. So 99% of the world's traffic runs through these subsea cables, which is something I did not realize. And there's a lot of geeky layer one stuff I think you guys will enjoy here of the design and maintenance of these fiber runs. Drew, what do you think?
Andy mentioned he called this hidden infrastructure, and it really is, but it's actually really essential to our modern lives, modern economy. We also get into some of the history of how all this developed, which is also fascinating. We get into issues around how you monitor these cables. We talk about some of the security risks to these cables. It's just a fascinating discussion. So buckle up and let your nerd get ready to be satisfied.
So Drew and I kind of geek out about some weird stuff. And this is one of those sort of weird things we're geeking out about. And I know in the past, 12 to 18 months or so, we've heard a lot about, the subsea cables and all of the telecommunications that are happening through that. So what is the role of these subsea cables in global network connectivity?
Yeah. So first of all, awesome question, and one that I think we could spend probably an hour talking about. So, subsea cables are a key hidden part of really internet web infrastructure. Most folks don't know they're there, don't realize they're using them, but they're pervasive. So, if you've ever sent a text to someone who's in Europe while you're in the US, you use a subsea cable, and these things carry hundreds and hundreds of terabits per day, 24/7, and they're pervasive around the globe. They are plentiful, but also probably not as many of them as people would expect, right? We've got dozens and dozens of key cables, but you would think that there might be hundreds or thousands. It's more in the dozens and dozens. And that's really interesting that, we've got this key piece of infrastructure, which, resides on the ocean floor, right? So literally a pretty hostile environment to both install and maintain. And yet these things are just absolutely key for keeping connectivity in the world together.
So you mentioned terabytes of information that are running across these cables?
I said terabits.
Terabits, sorry. Yep.
So just like, Ethernet, et cetera, choosing bits per second versus bytes, 8 bits in a byte.
Okay, so obviously critical infrastructure. Who owns these cables and who operates them, and are there differences?
There's a bunch of answers to that. You have some that are, kind of governmental, installed, literally run by a kind of state-owned telecom or something like that. You have a lot of them that are done, owned and installed by private companies. So it's a mix of the two. In the news, historically, you've seen large hyperscalers, social networks, et cetera, installing cables or buying certain slices of cables for their use over time. So it's really a mix, both kind of quasi-governmental telecom all the way to kind of very large internet scale companies will actually purchase segments of cables for routing their own traffic and capacity globally.
And when you say purchase a segment of cable, does that mean they'll purchase fibers within a larger cable, or how do you purchase a segment?
Yeah. So when I say segment, I literally mean pairs of fiber. Cables today are made up of strands of fiber, and you typically could buy some number of pairs if you'd like for your own purposes, and then kind of go about running your own multiplexing, et cetera, whatever you might like on top of that. Or you could buy waves, which means a particular wavelength of somebody else's fiber that you multiplex into there. Mm-hmm. So there's a variety of ways to kind of timeshare. Multiplexing is key around adding capacity to these capabilities using cables, and you can kind of timeshare your way into one. You could pull your own if you really wanted to, as some folks have done.
I saw some reports over the past year or so that some of the large tech companies have been either considering or at this point maybe starting laying some of their own cable. Is that just for their use? Do they also lease it out, or is it just mixed depending on who's doing what?
It's mixed. And typically what you'll see is literally pulling your own cable and saying, oh, this is the hyperscaler A cable. It typically doesn't make a lot of sense because these are resources that you can kind of share amongst a small group of people. So typically, folks, a large hyperscaler might take 25% of a cable. Another entity will take 25% of a cable. And then a telecom or something will take 50% of a cable. And they'll kind of share capacity in usually strands that they will carve out for each other through that. So it makes a lot of sense because the expense, if you think about installing these, first of all, the ocean is a very hostile place to work, right? And we're not talking about a quiet bay here. We're talking about the middle of the Atlantic, the middle of the Pacific. And this is one of these literal adventures installing these things. It's incredibly customized ships. It's incredibly technical work. You've got this very, high-tech cable. The cables are not passive in that, every 50 to 100 kilometers, there's amplifiers that go in there to kind of boost the signal up along its way through the journey. And so this is, really a precise thing. You have to know exactly where you're laying it, what the seabed conditions are, especially as you start to come up to where the cable lands, where it comes back into terrestrialville here, basically above the ocean. You've got to have that exactly the right spot. It's a very technical thing to do. They're tricky to install. They're even trickier to break when you have some kind of issue. you know, you've got to use some pretty sophisticated technology. First of all, you can find exactly kind of where the cable is broken by using a variety of kind of timing and resistive measurements, depending upon the type of cable. And then you've got to get a ship or two out there, and you've got, you know, again, it's the ocean. So your X and Y axis, you have full control over. Your Z axis, you don't. And you're dependent upon waves, wind, and all kind of the stuff that's thrown at you. And you've got to work with that to try to find the cable, yank that thing back up and fix it, which, you know, could be in thousands of feet of water, depending upon where the issue occurred.
I think our layer one people will be like completely nerding out with some of the mechanisms you just mentioned here for troubleshooting. But I had a question, because when I was kind of researching and looking through stuff, one of the things I saw was that the first transatlantic cable was laid in 1858. So, I mean, you just described a pretty complex process and lots of, you know, math and science and tools. How did we do this, you know, what, 100?
Coming on 200.
Yeah, coming on 200 years ago.
Right. This is crazy. So this is super interesting. So back in the 1850s was the first transatlantic, you know, between, I think it was somewhere in Newfoundland and Scotland, the first transatlantic cable that they laid. Might have been Ireland. But this is amazing. They did this with like paddle wheel steamships.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. This cable weighed, you know, thousands of pounds per mile, and you need obviously a lot of it. So this was this like just one of these amazing enterprises that you hear about. And, you know, so they put the cable in, and there was a lot of discussion about how this works. Now, the modulation of like, how do you actually encode data over this? I mean, literally, we're talking Morse code, right? So, you know, dots and dashes, because this is a telegraph cable. There's no such thing as voice, right? Like, this is a telegraph cable, which is astounding. So they ran this cable, and obviously, this design is unproven. This has never been done before. They get the thing in, and it doesn't really work that well, right? And this is one of the things that's like mind-blowing, which is just how this connection works, which is there's this kind of diplomatic like exchange of like congratulations on the cable. And it is between Queen Victoria and President Buchanan in the US, right? So this is just like mind-blowing that we're actually using this really, I mean, you know, Morse code is digital. So it's, I guess it's a digital technology back in the 1850s. So this cable does not work well. It takes like 16 hours for them to bang this message across because there's so much like echo, and this cable is entirely passive. So they were running a ton of voltage through it trying to get the
message. This wouldn't have been fiber, right?
Oh, gosh, no.
This is copper? What are we talking about?
Yeah, no, this is a copper cable that runs under the ocean between these two points. It's entirely passive. There's no amplifiers or anything in between. So you've literally got a telegraph guy on one end, and you've got a very sensitive receiver on the other end that's trying to pick up what's left of the electrons that were there when they clicked the paddle when they dispatched this message. And it doesn't work well. And actually, they basically end up shorting the cable out. They ran too much voltage. So this cable is eventually kind of abandoned. But then 10 years later, sometime in the 1860s, during the Civil War in the United States, they put another cable in with some better engineering. It was better developed. And this cable works great, right? They've got a couple other things figured out. And just from a communications perspective, one of the things that I love is this is the largest absolute improvement in human communication likely ever, right? Which is you went from literally to get a message across, you put it on a ship and somebody brings it over to it takes a couple minutes to send a telegraph. And that is just absolutely amazing. We haven't surpassed that kind of improvement even today, right? Even though we're shaving seconds and you can text someone anywhere in the world pretty much today, the improvement that we saw from the installation of that cable was likely our greatest achievement as far as being able to more rapidly communicate.
So these days we've moved on from copper, I presume. It's all fiber optic for these subsea cables?
So the first fiber optic cable went in the 1980s, right? So we're talking transatlantic. So, you know, it took a lot of copper in between. And there was also this very interesting interplay because you had the 1860s, this first transatlantic cable. Then in the 1900s, and literally 1901 was the first radio transmission across the Atlantic. So RF...
We started going wireless, yes.
With Marconi literally to Signal Hill in St. John's. And the interplay between cables and RF is like one of the really interesting things of telecom, because it was a thing back then. It's a thing now, right? Do you have fiber? Do you use 5G? Like, how do you get your connectivity? Do you have satellite or Starlink or whatever? So it's really, really interesting, the interplay between RF and, you know, a coaxial type cable to transmit data. So fiber didn't come along until the 1980s. That obviously was a massive step up in capacity and capability.
But in that time, we were also still using copper cable. Were we running voice over copper cable for transatlantic before we started fiber? Yeah.
All right. So to go through the chronology here, in the 1920s, overseas telephone service between the US and Europe started with RF. So literally you were using like a shortwave switch part of the spectrum to talk to someone. And that's like super complex, unreliable, relies on the atmosphere cooperating and a bunch of other stuff. And then in the 1950s, you had the first transatlantic telephone cable come in, which was a copper technology. And the specifics on this are kind of hilarious. I think it was like it had a couple dozen voice calls that it could support simultaneously. So like 30, 36 or something voice calls, plus 22 telegraph lines. And one of the breakthroughs is this is one of the first cables of this length, or it is the first cable of this length, to use inline amplification. And it had a really awesome vacuum tube-based amplifier that boosted the signal along. And this cable was really kind of pretty historic because this is the same cable that carried the infamous like Washington to Moscow hotline as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So literally this is all riding on this one copper cable in the 1950s. Copper continued, but then in the 1980s, really technology was at the point where fiber would just absolutely supplant it. A single cable in the 1980s, they got about 40,000 different voice wow. channels on that versus the 35 that they got out of a copper cable in the 1950s.
And I think of these cables undersea, like if you're running it, that you've got this like giant big bundle of cables, because just like anytime we run fiber, right, you're like, well, you might as well pull 50 extra strands because you're pulling it. And that's the hard part. But I read in an article somewhere that most of these cables, or a lot of them, are about the size of a garden hose through most of their path. I mean, obviously, they might have different numbers of pairs and strands in them, so I'm sure that's a factor. But what's the range here?
Yeah, so typically, and you know, this is information, which is there's a bunch of like online, this is again, one of these hidden infrastructure things that's not really secret, but it's just folks don't typically pay attention to it. So first of all, a lot of cables have a relative, modern cables we're talking about today, don't have a ton of strands. And the rationale there is with multiplexing, right, with wave division multiplexing, et cetera, you can jam so much into one strand. That you don't need 50 strands, right? And the expense of thousands of miles of fiber is material over time. So the more you can jam in, you know, essentially with wave division multiplexing, basically different colors of light are prismed out on one end and combined on the input end in order to give you a virtual basically sharing of a cable that is very efficient, very common and pervasive in networking. So you're right, which is the actual fiber component of these cables is really pretty minuscule, like literally the, like less than the size of a pencil. The rest of the cable is all the stuff to protect that. And it is insulation, it is copper that might be used. There might be copper in there depending upon how the amplification is driven. The repeaters, there can be copper conductors which actually power the amplifiers, or the amplifiers actually can be driven by optical power. So actually through a different strand that is reserved for amplification. And it's all bundled together and then put in this just kind of massive, very, very robust kind of steel chain looking exterior thing, which is meant to protect the cable from banging around in the seabed, rocks, inadvertent ships hitting it with their anchors, wildlife, like literally sharks and whales that sometimes have messed with these things historically. So it's, you know, it's literally sitting on the bottom of the ocean. You know, if you ever had an extension cord that you've left out like in a yard too long and then something randomly nibbles at it, like that same thing happens in the ocean.
I just have this picture in my head of like a burnt squirrel. Sorry. Oh,
a shark with a little burn mark on his snout.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there needs to be repeaters in these cables to get the light waves from one end to another. Can you talk about how they're integrated and what they're doing?
Yeah. So there's a natural tendency for a signal to fall off over time, right? So you don't notice this, you know, typically on like land scale, if you're building on a network, but once you get into wide area, signals fall off with the distance that they're going with different mediums having different attenuation ratios. And if we're talking about in fiber, light falls off over time. So if you actually want to push light through fiber a long distance, you have to at some point pick that light back up and amplify the signal. So you have to take what you have and then pump it up a number of decibels in order to make it readable on the far side. And there's a couple ways to do that. And again, I'm, you know, not a physicist here, but it's amazingly interesting because they've come up with some amazingly clever ways to do this with optical amplifiers. And optical amplifiers are basically, it's 100% solid state. There's no conversion from optical back to electrical back to optical. You're doing it all within the optical domain. And this is super good because you're going to take this thing and put it in a kind of bump on the cable that's going to literally sit on the bottom of the seafloor. So they have optical amplifiers, which basically take the input signal from the fiber, juice it up some number of decibels, and then shoot it back out. Mm-hmm. And the power for this actually comes from literally a laser that is shown down an alternate fiber. So they actually power the amplifier with light that then boosts up the signal coming in so that it goes back out. And this is repeated, you know, dozens and dozens of times as the signal makes its way through the cable, because otherwise the signal would degrade. You remember that's back in the 1850s, right? Essentially, when they burned out the insulation on that first cable, you would do the same thing if you tried to just send, like, let's say you got a really, really powerful, like GBIC type adapter or something, right? You had this giant laser on it. You would literally, you know, you'd probably melt the fiber for the amount of power that you would need to get into. So you have this notion of amplification along the way. And these are failure points, which is why, you know, the engineering around optical amplifiers is really, really impressive in order to get that signal from A to B and basically, you know, get the fidelity that went in, and the bits that go in are the same bits that come out.
Is this fiber custom made for this purpose? Because I, you know, in regular land-based networking, you know, we multi-mode for short, single mode for long, and then there's different core sizes and bandwidths that they can carry. But I mean, we're talking about thousands of kilometers sometimes here. Who makes this, and is it special made for this purpose?
Yeah, so there are certain types of fibers that you would buy, and they're very optically pure so that they minimize signal attenuation. And to your point, that's going to be different than something you might use on a LAN link where it's like, okay, it's going 15 feet and you're more concerned, or, you know, you're 5 feet and you're 5 meters or something. You're much more concerned with cost. In a long haul scenario like this, you're much more concerned with clarity and performance over time and stability, because you also, you know, literally, you know, swapping out your uplink port on your LAN or changing a line on a telephone pole that might be running fiber service to your home, that's a lot easier than retrofitting something at the bottom of the ocean. So yes, there's a custom clarity and brands of fibers made by, you know, a handful of manufacturers, small number of manufacturers. Again, this is super specialized. There's nothing in this industry, whether it's the ships that install it, what they're installing, who makes the amplifiers, et cetera. It's all highly specialized. Again, like, the ocean is not a friendly environment to work. The ocean's wonderful on a nice day. On the worst day, it's entirely inhospitable. And it is extremely challenging to think about all of the, just really the aggregate effort and work that has gone into the engineering around getting these cables to be reliable and literally something that most people have absolutely no concept even exists.
And how do they get back onto the land? I mean, I'm so curious about the physics of these, what did you call them?
Cable landing.
When you're amplifying them along the way.
The repeaters.
But yeah, let's talk about that landing. So once it's emerging out of the sea and hitting into land, what are we looking for there? Because there's some weird places where these things pop up on little tiny islands scattered around the world, in addition to the places that you would imagine along, you know, coasts. What are the requirements for that, and what happens?
So there's a couple different things here. So first of all, let's talk about like the large like continent, like, you know, North America, like where do you land cables? What the ideal situation is a gently sloping seabed with a nice sandy bottom that you can use to bury the cable in, so that you basically have the cable, you know, at some point the cable transitions from a subsea cable to a underground cable and then into this little, you know, literally the facility where it's landed. And you don't want, you know, if you have rocky, dramatic cliffs, that is not a good place to land a cable, right? You need a gentle seafloor so that you can, ideally, the cable will be buried in those spots. So they will actually kind of plow it in order to protect it from danger of just, you know, random ships or boats anchoring, et cetera. So you need this kind of ocean topography matched with a terrestrial topography that is complementary to the cable. The other thing is we have to think about is we do want to think about latency. So we want to try to be as close as possible to approximating the great circle route between two points. Just like when you're, for example, you're on an airplane and you're going to Japan, you fly over Alaska if you're coming from the East Coast in the US, right? Mm-hmm. And very similarly, you want your cable route to take the great circle route for a couple of reasons. One, because it's going to help latency. Two, because you're going to use less cable and it's going to be a lot less expensive. Mm. And you're going to have less faults or any issues, because the more cable you put in, the more likely you are to have issues.
So the cable is just laying on the bottom, and then as it gets towards land, they bury it under, and then it has to pop up somewhere. Where does it pop up? Who has that?
Yeah, so there's a variety of facilities where literally you have cable landings, and a lot of these are public, and, like, you know, you can literally look up online like what they look like, and they might have a small descriptive website. And these kind of harken back to like these black box telco buildings that we're probably all familiar with from like the late 90s, early 2000s, like the classic kind of central office vibe look, where it's this windowless building where these cables come in, they're terminated, and then there's a lot of terrestrial communications coming out of those buildings where those cables basically splay out into the greater internet infrastructure of that respective point.
So are these cable landing places sort of that size, or are they just sort of like a small hut before they get moved out, or is there actual like some serious physical infrastructure there?
It's somewhere in between. You know, driving the cables is like, there's a fair amount of oomph required to drive them. So it's not like just like, you know, two rack units of stuff. Mm-hmm. but it typically they're not, for example, co-location facilities. So typically you're not going to be able to like, you know, put facilities there, et cetera, but they are typically more of just like a telco scale. And it's actually interesting. It's probably one of the last kind of classes where you have that kind of telco scale infrastructure that is kind of opaque from the perspective of you don't really see the IP, you don't see layer three there, right? You're kind of down below that. You don't see kind of routing and termination there typically.
So we're talking a sort of windowless building, maybe a few stories where this cable is terminating and it's hitting what inside? A bunch of routers, a bunch of equipment to change optical signals to electrical signals? What's inside?
Yeah, so it's typically below the routing level. So if you think of the OSI stack, it's typically going to be below layer three. So you're going to be down and dealing with just, you know, literally link layer type stuff. So you're going to be moving it from the format that it sent across the cable, and then you're going to be moving it into a format to typically then redump into a terrestrial cable of some sort, right? So it's going to be kind of an optical progression with some switching perhaps, but very unlikely that you're going to actually have like layer three plus routing in there. You know, there's probably some of that in some spots, but I think the main goal is to get it out of the terrestrial. Because again, location-wise, if you think about where you are, you're in Newfoundland, right?
Okay.
You know, yeah, there's some cables that come into like New Jersey and Long Island, if we think about the East Coast of the US, but you're not necessarily coming into a point which is where the population is. You're coming into a point that is convenient to terminate that cable, both from a topography perspective and also from a great circle perspective.
Okay, so it's hitting maybe some switches and then being sent off to a more traditional telco or, you know, hyperscaler facility for transmission to its final destination.
Yeah, it's in getting piped into the network fabric of the organization that actually owns it, exactly. And that could probably be backhauled further, you know, from Newfoundland down to wherever, and then dumped into their network fabric and part of their routing layer at that point.
Okay.
I would guess that the terrestrial transport for this is easier. And so I'm curious, I noticed looking at some of the maps, and we've got these in the show links here for you guys, and don't go clicking on that unless you want to just forget what's going on for about an hour and get lost in these cool interactive maps. But I noticed that several countries, like in the same country, have, I think Chile and Brazil, you know, have these long coasts where they've scalloped these subsea cables to their own cities. Would it not be easier and cheaper to do it over land? Or is that just a topography? You know, maybe it's rocky, mountainous, too hard.
So local topography may play into that. The other point that's interesting is a little bit of what you're likely seeing there is an attempt to provide redundancy. So if we're going to go way back in the network and raise your hand if you remember what a FIDI ring is, right? So you've got, yeah, okay, there we go. Thank you. So you've basically got ring topologies that folks attempt to do with these so that it is not just a one point and here you go, but that a cable that comes to you, when you have these scalloped entries, if you're existing at any one of those scalloped entries, you actually have basically two cables, right? You have the cable going south and you have the same branch of the cable going north. So that if something happens on the southern leg of that cable, you can likely route your traffic to the northern side, and then they'll ultimately have another route around. So that's a little bit of, first of all, it might have to do with local topography, and I'm not an expert in the topography of Chile and their cable routing, so I'll pass on commenting on that one. But generally, they do try to think about how do we do these in a ring topology. For like transatlantic is different because it's like A to B, but with a lot of these other cables, they try to think about how do we do a ring topology to get us options for where it goes should we have faults.
So you mentioned, you know, despite the fact that these cables are essentially critical to international communications, there's not really all that many of them. So it does sound like redundancy is important. Can you talk a little bit more about how this infrastructure is made more redundant?
Yeah, so redundancy is super important. And this is one of the areas where kind of our expansive network bandwidth, right? We talked about here over 200 years, we went from lines that were one telegraph line to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of terabits per second. And what that's driven with the cables today is you don't actually need thousands of different individual cables. You can do so much in a single cable that you might need tens or dozens of cables. But then when you end up with tens or dozens of things, it brings other design considerations around redundancy into play. So first of all, one of the things is a lot of these cables, especially the kind of smaller cables, and this is like ones that connect islands, et cetera, they try to build them with a ring topology so that if you do have a fault at any point, you have more options than just, oh, well, the cable's down. For transatlantic cables, you know, there really isn't a conducive ring topology to really build there. So you do have multiple options for cables. Now, I will say that I do think we have a general challenge here where the topology of the subsea cables does not nearly have the redundancy that we do with terrestrial cables. And I think that's why you've started to see folks, in government start to realize that over the last handful of years and start to take this more seriously. And I'd say generally the whole networking space has that same vibe where, all of a sudden BGP vulnerabilities are something that folks are talking about much more, even though that's been a problem for 20 plus years. So, and I think subsea cables are exactly in the same thing, which is like, oh my gosh, we have all of our stuff is funneled through a small number of things. There are architectural things like ring topologies, et cetera, that are helpful. A lot of effort is also going into how do we monitor cables? Today that monitoring is passive, which is they know if it's damaged and they know where it's damaged. But I think over time that's shifting to more active monitoring where folks are able to kind of have more intel about what's going on around cables that they have.
So this is a security show, so we do need to talk about risk, and this is probably a good time to bring it in then. Can you talk about sort of the general categories of risks to subsea cables?
Yeah, so, at a high level, it's interesting, which is you're basically, you're pulling this string across the ocean, and then you're letting the string sink to the bottom, and then you're relying on that string for all your super important, like, network exchanges, and basically you're putting everything from phone calls to text to emails to data exchanges going into that. So, and this is super complicated because you're not talking about necessarily, like, something that folks own. You're talking about international waters. You're talking about the bottom of the ocean somewhere, in the middle of the Atlantic or in the middle of the Pacific. And the rules around that are really kind of Wild West, right? Because you're not talking about like law, you're talking about like maritime law all of a sudden at this point. So there has been a big realization where folks are, again, kind of thinking about the security of this super important asset that is now sitting on the bottom of the seafloor, and how do you manage that? And I will also say this is not a solved problem at this point. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more that needs to go into these because these are very important for our communications, but they're also, kind of really hard to monitor. Thousands of miles long, thousands of feet under the water, and there's a complex environment there. Again, you've got like kind of known natural causes, literally animals, rocks, just random ships and stuff, kind of bumping into things.
Undersea tremors and that kind of thing, that they can affect cables?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, I think the kind of plate tectonics movement you'd have to see to cause issues would probably cause a major, major, major tsunami as well. So,
we'd have other things to worry about.
Yeah, first order effects would probably be more important.
Yeah.
But the underlying issue here is that, you've basically got, an extension cord run through your neighbor's backyard, and you've got to try to figure out, how do you keep that secure over time? And it's a complicated one. It's one we don't fully have solved. The future here is probably a lot of more kind of active intel coming from the cables, more sensors on the cables. And I think probably with the next handful of years, even some level of like autonomous, drones to keep an eye on cables, right? Because it's that kind of thing where you really can't have humans keep an eye on this. It's literally down in an environment we can't survive in.
Could you give us sort of a percentage of what's the greater risk to a subsea cable? Is it a natural geographical or geological issue, or is it more like human caused, like unintentional, a ship anchor, fishing equipment or something damaging a cable?
Yeah. So what I would say historically is the issues have been, I think the largest category of issues have just been faults, right? Meaning like nothing specific happened, but something went wrong and we lost a strand or we lost a pair. I think in recent time, we've seen more, I think the ocean is something that we're, frankly, using a lot more. If we think about that cable in the 1850s, no one was going to find it, right? Nobody's out there trying to anchor in the middle of the mid-Atlantic and like that sucker's safe. But, the ocean is a busy place now. You've got wind farms offshore. You've got a variety of, commerce going on, fishing, et cetera. All those things potentially, right, like are operating in an environment where previously there was no operation. And that can, not necessarily, but potentially cause damage. I mean, I'll tell you, I know several folks who have inadvertently anchored and pulled up small undersea cables, right? Not like these like transatlantic ones, but like small cables. And, typically there's no damage. You literally just unhook it and throw it back in. These things are exceptionally tough. They're built to withstand marine environments. But it is, as we have, kind of more effort and work going on, more, production from our ocean, whether it's offshore wind farms or et cetera, it's just causing more activity. So the environment here is one that I think, again, we're going to need more sensors and management and monitoring so that it's not just something when you know when it breaks, but you know when something's going on around it.
And I think my question here is, there's a lot of accidental stuff that can happen. We've seen just various reports for, again, I think 12 to 18 months is this time period where we've just seen a news report, a news report, a news report, a little death by a thousand needles here. But sometimes it seems like, you know, maybe there's something intentional where somebody has broken a cable, tampered with the cable. You know, it sounds like since this is so far down the OSI stack, there's potentially nothing protecting that data from eavesdropping, tampering, et cetera. How hard is it? If somebody, you know, let's say I had some need and I decided I wanted to go sniff into one of these cables, what would I have to do to inject something in there to get visibility of that data?
You'd basically need to be a Bond villain, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's a complicated thing. First of all, and we're also going to go back to like, well, pretty much the vast majority of network traffic is also encrypted, right? So depending upon what you're using, unless you're still using Telnet and FTP or something, like, you know, you're pretty well secured because pretty much everything we're using day to day has some form of encryption. So you have a stack of things you have to solve for, which is, first of all, we're going to assume that you can somehow decrypt the contents that you're going to intercept.
Or Andy, let me throw this at you, because maybe not even just decrypt, but maybe you capture, stop, block, reroute it, copy it, replay it later. Like, I feel like there's a lot of attacks if you get, you know, on path, man in the middle attack, where you could do something besides just decrypt traffic. I'm just curious how hard it is. And would the monitoring that you're kind of proposing that we're going to be working towards, would it pick this up if somebody was tampering?
I think the answer is very likely would pick it up. And this would also be incredibly hard to do, right? To actually execute this, because you're literally talking about, you're going to need, you know, one of a couple dozen ships that are roaming around the world to do this, or you have to build your own ship in secret, right? So like, there's work to be done. And it kind of literally is it that like Bond villain level plot where you might need to have a ship that is like covertly has a submersible in it that can go down and work on the cable. So this is not something that necessarily a layperson is going to be able to execute. You know, you're talking about, you know, a really, really sophisticated actor in order to kind of pull this stuff off. And ultimately, again, you know, I think you're right. You could like reroute. I don't think, you know, if you're sending stuff on a cable and it doesn't get to the other end of that cable, somebody's going to notice. Could you record it or something? You know, certainly, potentially. But again, you know, I think there's probably easier ways. If I want to intercept something coming from you, probably the most complicated thing to do would be to be on the seabed of the Atlantic Ocean in order to do that, when I could probably just sniff your Wi-Fi from your driveway. So it's also kind of a risk that we have to think about, because again, you're not sending all your data through this cable, right? You're not running a VPN that's necessarily dumping everything through this cable. This is only the stuff that is going internationally, et cetera, that's going to be routed there.
I mean, it seems like the risk level is sort of at the level of geopolitical, where if I am a nation state and want to harm, you know, another nation state, cutting off their connection to the global internet would be a pretty good attack.
Yeah, and I think the axiom to go back to here is, right, you know, we've become super reliant on the internet for communication. And I think what we've seen over the last, like, literally 15 years, you know, the internet really is serious here. Like, this is the thing we're using, right? Like, who has a POTS line even left at home? Like, you know, if you do have a POTS line, it very likely, you know, is just a VoIP line in disguise. You don't even know that it's that. And, you know, we're relying on the internet for communication. And we're now, you know, as we go back through, we're seeing things like subsea cables, like I talked about BGP and kind of other like low level networking stuff that probably needs to be addressed in order to bring it to the level of reliance and seriousness that we all kind of feel that it has on a day to day basis. Right. So that kind of, if it's going to be our fabric of communication, I think there's a bunch of work to do to bring these things forward to where they need to go.
You mentioned there's interest in trying to, right now we're using passive monitoring. Could you talk a little bit about how that passive monitoring works and then how we might get to active monitoring on these cables?
Yeah. So when I say passive and active, meaning that like if something happens to the cable, right, they know pretty much instantaneously and they know exactly where it happens because there's means you can deduce to say, hey, how far, literally, you know, how many miles down the cable did this fault happen? And you're going to know right away.
Is that because of the repeaters there that allow them to take these measurements, or how do they know?
Well, actually, even in, so we all go all the way back to the mid-1800s with these first cables, there's a variety of ways to measure cable length using a combination of inductance, resistance. If you've got multiple cables, you can do all kinds of cool electrical tricks to measure, and you can do the same thing with different technologies and techniques in fiber. The repeaters don't really have a role in necessarily that measurement, except that they're actually changing what the measurement is through their repeating function. But you can basically pretty accurately determine where a fault is, meaning a fault means like a break or a cut or a significant drop off in light. You can pretty accurately detect where that is, because otherwise these things would be absolutely impossible to repair. Like, you can't pull up the entire cable and check the thing. You need to know a specific segment that you would need to check. So ultimately, you can pretty rapidly diagnose where the faults are in this cable. And if you've never had the, like, even if you get basic Ethernet testers today. Like if you buy like a, you know, a Fluke meter or something like that, you can literally plug in and say, how long is this cable? And it's going to tell you exactly to the foot how long the cable is. And that's using the same kind of mechanism back from the early days in the mid 1800s that they used to basically measure where faults were in cables, et cetera. So it's kind of a cool twist. You can do that.
And so passive monitoring to me sounds like I sent the signal at one end, it didn't arrive at the other end. That's a problem. What would active look like?
Yeah, active monitoring. So think about, I mean, you know, having more sensors, which is like, hey, am I detecting any vibrations near me? Right? Like, what would that look like? You know, basically having the cable be a little bit more than a cable, but a cable in a monitoring system. Not necessarily that you're going to have like a webcam down there, right? To be able to look around, like a little pan, tilt, zoom, like, you know, motion detected at subsea cable, right? Like you're going to get a push notification. So having a little bit of humor there, but basically, you know, environmental sensors to know that, hey, there's a change with the water column pressure at this cable at this area has changed. And what does that mean? It means somebody's pulling it up, right? So there's all these kinds of other things that you could monitor, which is, you know, vibrations, water column pressure, variety of other stuff that's probably even more detailed that will give you a bunch of information about the environmental factors, temperature, obviously, that the cable is being susceptible to, which would then give you information about what's going on. Kind of like knowing the temperature in your house, right? It doesn't necessarily tell you that there's somebody there or there's somebody not there, but it lets you know that something's wrong if your house is only 40 degrees Fahrenheit and you might need to get something fixed.
Right.
So that and then active monitoring as well, like literally, you know, there's folks that are working on making like little drone ships that'll go like submersible drones that'll go patrol these things and keep an eye on them. So it's really hard to get down there to look around in person.
So we could get some shark versus drone videos.
Yeah. You know, and I'll just say the other thing is it's pitch black down there. Right. I mean, there's very, very, very little light, you know, from that perspective. So I don't know that you're going to get a good shark versus drone video, but I mean, the ocean's absolutely amazing. Right. And just to think about like a drone view fly by over the bottom of one of these cables would be absolutely amazing. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see where this goes. And there's a lot of that stuff, obviously, that I would assume is being worked on because you're not going to sell, you know, tens of thousands of these things, whatever the monitoring. This is a very small market, but also with a really, really sophisticated asset to protect.
Andy, do you have any thoughts on any of the group efforts or consortiums that are like nonprofits that are International Cable Protection Committee or any of the international groups that are trying to do oversight for, you know, all of that stuff that you mentioned is that that's, you know, maritime law, international waters, et cetera. Can we ask about that?
Yeah, I don't have any specific thoughts other than I think it's a really important mission to just like, this is not something that one country can do on its own, right? These are things that I think run, and especially when you start to talk about some of these smaller like island nations that end up having a bunch of cables funneling through them, I think they likely need kind of help and input and guidance on just what exactly they're supposed to do, because the difference between a fishing boat and a boat causing a problem with a cable is probably really hard to determine from far away. So I don't have any specific comments, I guess, on their efforts other than to say that, you know, this is a good process to have to kind of discover internationally how we want to treat these things because they're really important to modern civilization.
All right, Andy. Well, looking at the map, there's some weird things that you see because you'll just kind of, when you're zoomed out, you see lots of these cables converging to seemingly some just random spot in the middle of an ocean. But if you zoom in, what you see are these like little tiny islands. I don't even know the names of them in some places. And then also, you know, along coast and other parts of the world, you'll see that a lot of them tend to, you know, aggregate towards, you know, the coast of one specific country versus another, you know, that are nearby. It might have been more of a direct shot. So I'm curious, like, without getting into political statements, but obviously the relationships between, you know, whether it's the US or other countries and the entities where these things are terminating on the other end plays a role, you know, in how the data is handled, how the data is protected once those subsea cables come up and they're terrestrial. So I'm just curious, like, what are the thought processes or decision points, inputs into that?
Okay, so a bunch there. So first of all, talk a little bit about like, why do all these, especially if you look at like the South Pacific, there's a ton of smaller island nations that have cables interconnecting to them. And I would say, first of all, like think of this from the perspective of the small island nation, which is this cable or these cables, plural, is effectively the lifeblood of the digital economy for your country. So if you have the opportunity to get a cable landed or a cable landing station or to get a split off a cable to come into your country, that is absolute gold. Because especially if we go, you know, back in time, like 3-4 whole years before Starlink was a thing, you literally had like no connectivity, right? Like this is it. Like this is how you get into the modern internet.
Smoke signals.
Which does not work well when you're an island country, you know, because you can only see it so far, right? Smoke signals only travel. So these things are absolutely like lifeblood for small countries that need to get online. And there's the only continent that doesn't have a cable to it is Antarctica, right? So that's it. So the penguins are on their own. And if you look at, you know, there's a bunch of even Arctic islands, et cetera. If we think like Svalbard, et cetera, they have cables, right? So this is really what interconnects you to the globe today. So I think that from the perspective of these small countries, you know, this is a huge win for them when they're able to get interconnections to these cables. You know, again, especially before Starlink, I mean, that was your only option to be on the modern web. If we pivot a little bit, I don't think that necessarily you end up in a situation where those cables are always like landing there. You know, sometimes those folks will just get a split off an existing cable. So they're not necessarily like routing all the traffic through that country, but that country is potentially tapping into a cable that's already there. So it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, don't think of it like at each one of those dots, every bit of traffic from the cable is coming in and then necessarily all going back out. That country could just be kind of slicing into the cable or getting a Y off the cable rather than having, you know, kind of the whole cable terminate there. But again, you also bring up a, you know, super interesting point, which is you're into this notion of maritime law versus local laws, et cetera. It is incredibly complex. I'm not a lawyer. I won't speculate on it. But generally, from the perspective, if you've ever traveled to any of these places, you know, like I was in Iceland like a while ago, and it was just that the connectivity was amazing. When you think about, there's very little, like, you know, from a data perspective that I'm using that's in Iceland, but it appears that you're, you know, in London, because why? You're being teleported over this cable that is incredible capacity in order to get you great internet access, great calling, Wi-Fi, the whole nine yards.
So you mentioned Starlink, and you talked earlier in sort of our history of building out these cable networks, there was also a little bit of competition between, you know, RF and running a cable. And now with things like, you know, Starlink, Project Kuiper and others, there's some serious competition to do satellite-based broadband. Could you envision a day where subsea cables become less important because of RF capability?
I think there's a ton of folks that are thinking about this. I think the answer today is no. The reality today is that, you know, you're limited RF, you're intrinsically, meaning in the air RF, you're going to have much less bandwidth available to you than you do within a coaxial type environment, like a fiber, et cetera, where you're kind of have, you know, you can use whatever element of the electromagnetic spectrum you want, up to including light, which is going to pack a lot more data into it than you're going to get down at the RF over the air layer. But that being said, you know, SpaceX is doing incredibly clever stuff where, you know, they've got lasers between satellites up into space. So they're basically using optical up in space. Absolutely amazing. Obviously, with clouds, that is problematic from the ground up, from an uplink and downlink perspective. But it is a very, very interesting kind of way to think about potentially having backups. Now, you know, the challenges we talked about, you know, one kind of modern cable has capacity in the hundreds of terabits per second. That is super fast. You know, so I don't know that we're going to be able to get that level of performance from a satellite uplink downlink. But it is a very interesting kind of alternate, you know, capacity stream that I think we probably need to think a bit more seriously about using.
Maybe this is a good place to wrap up too, but it sounds like really, maybe this is just me, I didn't realize how much of our traffic went through these cables. And I think probably just thinking about it and looking back and saying, oh, we've been trying to do this for almost, you know, 200 years and people are dragging them up with anchors and this is happening and it's expensive and it's hard. So I think, you know, those technologists of us thinking about the future were thinking, well, maybe this is the legacy mechanism for connectivity. But what I'm hearing from you is actually this is pervasive and it's going to be even more critical as we're pushing more global data around and we need to modernize and monitor these systems and these cables better.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think this kind of technology, subsea, you know, aside of us discovering some new communications mechanism that allows us to do this, this is very likely the path forward, very likely to be augmented by satellite and spots, which makes total sense. It's totally congruous. I think that subsea cables and kind of this, you know, high throughput, reliable, kind of ever-present, always-on connectivity, that forms the fabric of, you know, really every communication medium that we're using today. And, you know, anybody in a group chat with folks internationally, the expectation is that things instantaneously work. And, you know, I don't think we've become more patient as a society. I don't think we're going to go back to waiting 2 weeks for messages to be steamed across the Atlantic. You know, so the notion of subsea cables are here to stay. You know, we're connected with a web of them. I think it's going to be an ongoing challenge going forward about just monitoring, management, et cetera. But, you know, I think they're well poised for success. We're literally coming up on, you know, 200-ish years and another 30 years or so of, you know, having these things, which is really terrifyingly amazing to think about. The amount of engineering that went on back then and, you know, still continuing to this day.
So you're saying I should decline the investment I've been offered in a carrier pigeon network? That doesn't seem like a good bet.
Well, there is an RFC for that, so you can always fall back.
<That's>...
Wow.
Andy, thank you. This was like a great conversation about hidden infrastructure. Really fascinating. So thank you for your time. And obviously you're passionate about this. Thank you for sharing that passion. If folks want to connect with you online or find you somewhere along one of these subsea cables, where can they find you?
Thanks, Drew. Thanks, JJ, for having the discussion. I think it's great to just, you know, get more folks aware of the infrastructure under our feet and under the water. You can find me on LinkedIn, also post occasionally on X. So feel free to look me up on either one of those.
All right. That's Andy Champagne from Akamai. Thank you, Andy, for joining us. And thanks to you, the listener, for being with us for another episode of Packet Protector. If you have a topic you want us to cover or a comment or a correction or a question, you can reach out at packetpushers.net/FU. And we do love and appreciate when listeners reach out. By the way, Packet Protector is part of the Packet Pushers podcast network. That network includes a dozen technical podcasts for your professional development on networking, security, IPv6, DevOps, and more. We've got an industry blog, two weekly newsletters, a community Slack group, a YouTube channel, even an IRC group. You can find it all at packetpushers.net, all free with no login required. Thanks for listening.